Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and I hope you've all enjoyed your Christmas break. I'm Ali Milani. Welcome to Politics Uncensored. Last few weeks, we've been looking back at some of my favourite interviews from 2023 as we approach the end of the year, and I'm going to be continuing that this week. Every week, I'm joined by different guests on this show, and we discuss the biggest political stories of the week. In June, Labour MP for Norwich South, Clive Lewis, gave us his thoughts on that week's news. Really, really interesting. Clive Lewis ran for leader and is being tipped as a potential future leadership candidate in the Labour Party. So it's really worth getting his sort of views and slant on the politics of the day. Have a listen to that interview back in June this year. Clive, I think we've got you back now.
Good. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you excellently. Sorry about that. That's brilliant. I don't know if you could hear me, but basically we're talking about this Onward report that is finding that as people are getting older, they are not becoming more conservative, as had been the case with previous generations. What's your initial reaction to that?
Well, I suppose if you're a young person listening to this show, then it probably doesn't come as too much of a surprise, given that this is the Conservative Party has literally overseen the decimation of public services. It's failed to act on the climate crisis. It suppressed people's ability to even protest or take action for higher pay in terms of anti-trade union legislation. We know that baby boomers now, the older generation, have snaffled far more of public wealth, of GDP, than people who go perhaps under 40, under 30. So, you know, in terms of the cost of living crisis, it's being disproportionately the burden is disproportionately on a younger generation. And I guess they're voting with their feet. So it doesn't come as a complete surprise and a complete shock. Where they end up, though, I think is probably as interesting. And I think with the fragmentation of kind of centre and left parties across Western democracy, but particularly here in the UK with our first past the post system, that means that the Conservatives will still continue to get in more often than not, even with a declining share of the vote.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm curious about is whether this is actually an existential crisis for the Tories. I mean, unfortunately, our really outdated democracy means that you're right, they probably will survive. But they tend to do this thing where they say, you know, this is just a woke generation, that the reason that the Conservatives aren't maybe connecting with younger people is because wokeness is running rampant. The actual report from a right-wing think tank is saying the things that millennials, top five issues that millennials care about are the economy, the NHS, the environment, housing, and issues, taxation and equality. And actually, what I found most interesting about the report is that it's actually saying that millennials tend to be more left-wing economically. They think equality should be prioritized over economic growth, and a person's position in society is due to outside factors rather than individual effort. So it's no surprise, is it, that while the Conservative Party have gone on this far-right rampage where they're talking, you know, attacking trans people, attacking migrants, attacking refugees, while we have nowhere to live, in a cost of living crisis, it's no surprise that young people are leaving the party, no?
No, it isn't. It isn't a surprise. But I mean, if you take the longer view of history, I mean, they are the most successful political party in the Western world, with good reason. They can morph and change. They're obviously a party of political power, of established power. That's really clear if you look at their history over the last 400 years. But they're also a party that is able to adapt very effectively. They morph. You know, the Conservative Party that we have now isn't the same Conservative Party that you had, say, in the 1970s, and it's not the same party you had in the pre-war period. You know, so, you know, this is the party they are masters of being able to adapt and change, mm-hmm. and to stay in power. So I don't think you can write them off. I think you'd be stupid to. And, you know, they would always look out for their class interest, and they're very good at doing that. But can they bring, you know, they are an alliance of different interests, and can they bring young people back into the fold? It's really interesting that you called an economy with more equality left wing. That's not always been the case.
Yeah.
You know, in the immediate post-war period, I would have said that to varying degrees, both of the two main political parties in this country would have agreed that the public sphere, the public realm, public services, caps on how much money, you know, companies could make, limits on that. These were things that were commonly accepted. I don't think they're necessarily left wing, but what we have at the moment is a conservative party that is addicted to a 60-year-old creed. It's almost a cult of Thatcherism, a cult of free markets, when they have now been comprehensively proven not to work. If you don't believe me, go and look at adult social care as an example. Look at water. Look at rail. These have failed as privatizations of them that the market knows best. Look at the climate crisis. That is, in part, a failure of free market ideology. So I think this notion that these are left-wing sentiments is wrong. And I think you should watch out for the Conservative Party. They can merge. They can change. They can shapeshift. And I wouldn't be surprised if that process is going to take place. Which way they go, whether they go down a right-wing rabbit hole of Liz Truss, Rees-Mogg, and others, or whether they adapt to something different, is up for debate.
This is what I'm interested in. I think your analysis is spot on. My question is, you're right in that they're highly adaptive. They are a party of established power, but something, maybe it's my young naivety, but something seems different, at least in my lifetime. They seem to have been hijacked by the Jacob Rees-Mogg, Nadine Dorries sort of wing of the party. And we saw that in the very fact that Liz Truss won such a big majority over Rishi Sunak, and he only became prime minister after she collapsed. Do you think they are capable of, I mean, you're seeing conservative colleagues day to day, are they capable of sort of rebranding, of adapting to meet some of these issues, or are they now hijacked by a dogmatic far-right section of the party?
I think yes, they are, effectively, and they're held together by the first-past-the-post voting system, and we'll see who comes out on top. I would say the people that you've mentioned, Nadine Dorries, Rees-Mogg, and others on the right of politics, Richard Tice and others, there's a reason. Stuart Hall, who was a kind of an academic cultural theorist, kind of came out with this expression, which was that culture eats policy for breakfast. And what you're seeing with that part of the Tory, of the Conservative Party, is this reaction against a changing world, a world where a younger generation are more liberal on everything from trans to race, to how society should be created, who should have wealth, who shouldn't, how we should construct ourselves as a society. And that, those are cultural issues. But they're locked into this belief that basically established itself probably in the late 19th century, the height of imperialism, which is a kind of view of what the world should look like. It is a world dominated by white, wealthy men. And they kind of packaged that up and exported it to the rest of the empire. And they've held on to that. And for the last kind of 80 years, they've been fighting a rearguard action against a modern changing world. And what you're seeing at the moment is a kind of backlash against this changing world, whether it's on trans issues, whether it's on Black Lives Matters, kind of critical race theory, whatever it is. It's this hatred of the fact that they feel that they're losing control, that they're losing, and I use this expression purposefully, the whip hand in how our culture and how it moves forward. Culture is really interesting because culture is the lens through which you see the world. It's through how you understand the world, how you understand the economy, how you understand policies. So they are right to want to fight it, I think, but I think they're increasingly in a minority, which is why they're fighting so viciously. But it's also a toxic view of culture, a toxic view of the world, one that I think increasingly people can see through. Yeah. But they have a lot of allies on their side. They have a right-wing media, and they have a lot of people who don't want to engage in this battle for ideas, for culture. And that means that they get to dominate the field. But I think those people are culture warriors, but it's a culture from the 19th century, and I think it's one that should be, hopefully, consigned to the dustbin of history. But I think that's why they are at odds with perhaps other parts of their party who are perhaps more pragmatic and look more at their economic interests and accept that the world is a changing place.
Yeah, I mean,
that's just one take on it.
Sure.
You know,
So the other point is, I mean, that's the Conservatives element, and I think we could talk all day about where they are and how they're going to try and fight out of it and whether they'll be able to adapt. But for me, there is a unique opportunity here for a party, a progressive party, a party on the left. The terms in British politics is difficult to use, but a Labour Party, for example, to talk about issues like the environment, like housing, like progressive taxation and other things. Because when I'm looking at this report, which is by a right-wing think tank, it says everyone from 18 to near 40s, their top five issues include the environment. And, you know, this is an issue that clearly didn't make it into Rishi Sunak's top five priorities that he released. But you are the co-chair of the APPG on the Green New Deal, which believes that climate change is fueled by a broken economy. And you've called for radical reform to social and economic and political model to deal with our climate crisis. Is there not a really big opportunity here for a progressive Labour Party to make the argument that clearly the voters want to hear about on the issue of the environment?
So, yes, there is. And I must give my party credit. It has addressed many of those issues. So the £28 billion a year.
Yes.
From Labour Party on investment in that green transformational plan. It's a start. It's not enough, but it's a start, and it's better than it's coming from any other political party, as far as I know, perhaps with the exception of the Green Party. Mm-hmm. And that's,
but I mean,
just
not,
but they're obviously with one MP. That's not going to happen.
Sure, but Clive, I guess what I'm talking to you about. Sorry to interrupt you. But I guess what I'm talking about is I agree the policy issues are there, and I was really happy at party conference when I saw some of those things announced. But it can be central to the narrative of the kind of country we want to build, the kind of government we want to be. I think that opportunity is there.
I'm going to come on to that. Okay. So I think the problem we have at the moment, and I often feel like I fixate about this, but I think it whilst it isn't a panacea, what we have at the moment is a political voting system. And this will explain, I think, why the Labour Party is in the quandary it's in, where it can't talk about those things. So, you know, if you speak to most people in this country, they probably wouldn't put stopping desperate human beings crossing the channel or showing or having a humane asylum system as their top priority. But if you listened to the political class, if you listened to the newspapers, it is. Most people are concerned about the fact, will they be able to get their cancer treated in time? Will their elderly parents be looked after properly? Will they be able to keep their energy, their lights on and put food on their table? That is what most people's concerns are. And yes, they're concerned about the NHS and they're concerned about the climate. What this government is doing is looking at symptoms of those bigger issues. But what First Past the Post does, it basically, whether it's Mondeo man, Worcester woman or Red Wall voter, it takes a caricature of a group of swing voters, about a million people in a certain number of key swing seats that happen under First Past the Post. And with the use of mainstream media, they basically tell these people, these are what the political issues are. And they're the political issues which favour, frankly, the ruling elites, the political establishment, whoever you want to call them, the Conservative Party in this case, and what their interests are. And it allows you to manipulate the political talking points. Mm-hmm. And what is considered politically allowable within that. And the result of that means that all of the two main political parties in particular, who are the two winners from First Past the Post, have to have message discipline, which is, well, this is the issue that we have to talk about. Therefore, these are the issues, the narrative that we will focus on, and we will discipline our party to do that. And that's the tyranny of First Past the Post. And actually, all those other issues you've mentioned, Ali, get pushed to the sidelines in so many ways. And so actually, I think...
Clive,
vote according to who they want.
Votes
matter than were counted. Then I think you'd see political preferences and what people actually want politicians to be talking about, and to have that narrative would be far more effective and far more kind of connected in to where people are. And that just doesn't happen at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, look, I felt that tyranny desperately in an election campaign when I knew the issues, not just the issues, but the solution to the issues was so broad and required so bravery, but was continuously told we had to stick to one or two topics because, you know, that's what the system had dictated the election would be about. And I want to lastly talk about this with you, and I hope you don't mind, is an issue of bravery. I'm going to maintain that I'm still young. You're allowed to disagree. But one of the issues that, you know, when I'm talking to friends, colleagues, around politics, one of the things that our age group is desperately looking for is a little bit of political courage. anyone can respond to a focus group, can regurgitate what they're told in a focus group. But what we want is our politicians to have the bravery, the courage to address some of these issues in the way that they deserve. Things like Black Lives Matter, that's why they've been so prominent. You have launched a campaign calling on Rishi Sunak to enter negotiations with Caribbean leaders on paying reparations for Britain's role in slavery. Now, it takes an incredible amount of courage to talk about this issue, because we know the way that some of the mainstream media and some of mainstream politics reacts to this. Can you talk to us a little bit about this campaign, but also, you know, what caused you to bring this up, and whether you think that your colleagues and our politics in general just needs a little bit more courage to talk about issues that may not be what is focus grouped as the top five issues?
Yeah, and thank you for saying that, because it isn't an issue that really makes my timeline very pleasant on social media.
I can only imagine.
And it's not something you enter into lightly. Well, first of all, I have Caribbean heritage. I'm half Grenadian. So that gives me a kind of, I suppose, added incentive to speak up on this. It's something that I've been speaking. I'm the chair of the British Caribbean Association, and Lord Boateng, Paul Boateng, who you may recall worked under Tony Blair, gave a really fantastic speech about the challenge and the need for voices inside Parliament to speak up about reparations. And it really hit a nerve. And then a little while later, just to kind of background, a little while later, the Trevelyan family discovered through the University College London archives on slavery that of the hundreds of billions of pounds of today's money that was paid to the slave owners, and not the slaves, at the abolition of slavery, that they profited very handsomely from that. So they went there to apologise and to set up a trust fund for people in Grenada. And they worked with CARICOM, which is a kind of economic organisation of different Caribbean islands, to do that. And I gave a speech in Parliament, and I connected and reached out to them. And we're now busy working on a campaign. But the reason I think that became very clear to me, if you look at the Caribbean has been left in a dire state. It is one of the most impoverished parts of the world, and the least prepared for the climate crisis that's heading our way in terms of food security, energy access, and rising sea levels, and all the storms and hurricanes that we know are going to devastate those islands in the years to come. And yet, at the same time, the kind of irony, the evil irony, if you want, is that they, over 400 years, were ruthlessly, there was genocides, there was mass murder. And this country and other European countries brutally extracted from those people and those countries vast wealth that they invested in their industrial revolution. And, you know, that racist ideology that was developed to justify that is the structural racism that we see all around us, that we see internationally and we see nationally. And I think this country is a wonderful country. But I think as countries, we often tell ourselves stories. And good history is about constantly going back to those stories and reappraising them. And I think this country, after Brexit and its kind of post-imperial period, it needs a period of catharsis. It needs a period of understanding its history. And the history we currently tell ourselves is that we gave up our empire after we beat these really nasty Nazis. And then we created this really nice world order in which everyone kind of holds hands and sings Kumbaya and everything's nice. And we're the good guys. You know, this is a great country, but it has to live up and face up to some of the darker parts of its history. Now, some people say, well, we know what that was, but the stories that we tell ourselves and the legacy.
I'm not sure we do know.
That period of what we did, how we became wealthy, how we became one of the biggest economies in the world, and how we still keep many of those countries and left them in poverty, particularly the Caribbean, is not a part of the story that is widely known. So part of reparations is about having that conversation with the country so that we can move forward. We can close that chapter properly. But to do that, you have to look at the state of the Caribbean at the moment. It is one of the poorest parts of the world. We've left it that way, despite the fact of what it's contributed to this country. And we owe it a debt. You know, these people have come over here. You know, they helped build this country. They came over to help rebuild it after the war. And then many of them were deported. And now they can't get compensation through Windrush. I mean, you can't make this story up.
Yeah.
And the islands they've come from are now about to be devastated by the climate crisis, caused mainly by the industrialization process that they were broken on to build. So, it's a social and economic justice story, but it's also a story and a campaign which tells the story of this country. It's in many ways, it's about taking on the culture war, but on our terms. And actually, yeah. I think the reason I think it's important is because the vast majority of people in this country, when they understand the story, will understand that there is a sense of natural justice and that this country can be, you know, a brilliant country in the future if it wants to be, if it lives up to its obligations that it has to other parts of the world.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's one of those things. I agree with you. Look, I think this is an amazing country. I love our community here. I love being here. And I think it's only a testament to the health of our democracy and us as a country to be able to recognize with clear eyes what we've done, the darker parts of our histories, but also what we can do now to address them. It's really important that our politics and our politicians and legislatures recognize that we're not in moment zero. This isn't the first episode of the series. We're several seasons in, and we need to take actions to address things. And, you know, I'm particularly enthralled by the way you've intertwined your answer in that this isn't just a foreign policy issue. It's an environmental issue. It's an economic issue. It's a human rights issue. They're all interlinked. Yes. And if we're going to deal with the climate crisis, we're going to deal with it as one world. We're not going to deal with it as 200 countries.
We can't keep dealing with the symptoms. The symptoms are war, destabilization, refugees, violence, the works. And you know, there are too many politicians that just want to basically talk about, you know, spending defense reviews, increasing our ability to deal with the symptoms. And we have to think about dealing with, you know, the causes and tackling those. And that's poverty, the climate crisis, various other things that we need to get our head around and create those international institutions that can do that. And if we don't do that, we're going to be forever. You can never throw enough resources into tackling the symptoms of those crises. You know, you can never build enough tanks, enough planes, enough missiles. You're always going, you just can't. So you need to deal with the symptoms. It's like in this country, you know, a lot of people think about tackling crime, and we know what the right wing view is. You build more prisons and you give the police more powers. Well, that's certainly one approach.
And we've been doing it a long time and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, they have. And the way that you try to deal with it, you deal with the causes and the symptoms, which are, you know, we know that poverty, we know that, you know, poor housing, we know that poor jobs, insecurity, we know all those factors, unequal societies help generate, you know, the conditions for more criminality. So, you know, how do you tackle the root causes rather than simply, you know, giving the police more armaments or more wealth or more resources, building more prisons? That's the American system. I don't think it works. And I think actually that's the whole argument behind defund the police, not necessarily take money away from the police to stop them policing, but to stop arming the police and to stop making that the premier route to tackle these issues. And I think that's right. You know, now we've got a police force that's saying it can't deal with mental health cases. Well, there are lots of things to unpack in that. Actually, you know, maybe we should be putting more money into the causes of that mental health.
Thank you, Clive. Listen, I wish I had longer with you, but we've reached the end. I hope we can get you back on. But one of the things is, you know, we're talking about this issue around millennials today, but some of your answers and being able to have the bravery to deal with some of these key issues that aren't necessarily on the top five issues that Rishi Sunak or even other political parties may talk about is really, really important. And intertwining them with things like the environment will certainly get millennial ears listening and their feet more likely to go towards the ballot box. Thank you so much, Clive, for joining us. That's Clive Lewis. So that was Clive Lewis, MP for Norwich South. Very, very interesting discussion with Clive. We're moving on now. In the week where Lucy Letby was handed 14 whole life orders after murdering 7 babies, political activist and co-founder of Our Future, Our Choice, Femi Oluwole, joined me on Week Unwrapped to dissect not only that issue, but also the implications beyond a single case. You will have seen Femi on all sorts of media as well as social media. I was really looking forward when we had the chance to get him in the studio, and do give a listen. Femi, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about a number of issues, and we're going to end on education. But first, I want to talk to you a little bit about one of the breaking pieces of news this week, and that's that bosses at Britain's biggest company saw their pay packets rise by almost 16% on average last year, as most workers' wages were squeezed by rising prices. The High Pay Centre said the median pay of FTSE 100 chief execs was 3.91 million in 2022, up from 3.38 in 2021. It added that the average earnings of FTSE 100 bosses was 118 times more than a typical UK worker on 33k a year. Critics called the earnings extreme, but some of the firms argued that they were in line with competitors. Now, Femi, cost of living crisis, people can't afford to do their shopping. They have to pick between heating their house and putting food on their children's plates. And we've got some of the richest in London getting richer. FTSE 100 bosses, chief execs, getting on average 16% pay rise. This is a slap in the face of the British public, is it not?
Yeah, this just tells us exactly why we all have to vote, because we often think that politics is this thing far removed. It's just old men shouting at each other in Westminster, but they have the power to change this. The UK is one of the most financially unequal countries in the Western world. I think we're fourth most financially unequal in Europe. We have the worst regional inequality of any large major economy. And this is what you see. You end up seeing this sort of thing. And the reason why the politics that we currently have allows that to happen is because we have a party in power that literally, was it Rishi Sunak last summer, about this time last year, bragging during his leadership race about how he defunded deprived urban areas in favor of rich ones like Tunbridge Wells. We have a government that deliberately tries to make sure that the rich get richer. I mean, Liz Truss, last year when she was doing her mini budget, she literally said it is fair to give more money to rich people. This is the attitude. This can be changed. We can live a better life. But the politicians won't let us, which is why we have to vote.
Why do you think there's such a hesitancy within British politics to really go after some of the unequalness in terms of pay packets? I mean, we saw it in 2008. After the 2008 crash, when everyone was suffering, we saw the bankers' bonuses that went out and the outrage from the public. We've now seen with the cost of living crisis a 16% increase when nurses and doctors, train drivers, teachers are told to jog on. But there seems to be a consensus in Westminster that in order to govern, we need to bring these big businesses with us, and therefore a little bit of a fear to go after these pay packets, whether in rhetoric or policy. There just seems to be a fear. Why do you think that is?
It's because we don't have a real democracy. We have, as I said, the attitude of the Tories is give the rich, make the rich richer. But they only got 44% of the vote. The majority of the vote went to parties that were much more towards the left. Labour, Lib Dems, Greens, SNP, that's more than 50% of the vote just there with those parties. And if you do the polling, it says, I think it was 63% of the public are in favour of taxing the rich more. That is just the view that we are a country that believes in taxing the rich to help the poor. But unfortunately, because of our voting system, we end up giving absolute power to a party that believes in the exact opposite, the reverse Robin Hood.
And absolute power having not received more than 50% of the vote from the public, yeah, as well.
Especially, they didn't get 50% of the vote. They got 44%, and now we have a prime minister that wasn't even the leader of the party at the time of the last election, doing things deliberately to make us poorer.
Yeah, and he wasn't voted through. On the Tories, I think we're exactly on the same page. I wonder what you think about Labour and Liberal Democrat responses to this as well, because they seem hesitancy. I mean, they both want to present themselves as the party of business. I guess part of that is around the rhetoric of the economy and safety within the economy, making sure that businesses feel safe to invest here, to create jobs. But there does seem to be a bit of hesitancy from opposition sides as well as it relates to big business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's largely because essentially there isn't a Conservative Party anymore. The Conservative Party, the traditional Conservative values that you would think would be Conservative, i.e. being sensible with the economy, being prudent, being a lack of intervention into our private lives, that sort of thing. That party doesn't exist within the Tories anymore. They're the same party that flirted with the no-deal Brexit. They trashed the economy with Liz Truss. They're banning protests, the exact opposite of everything that traditional conservatism was supposed to stand for. And so that's why you have the Lib Dems and even Labour now trying to move into that space, trying to reclaim the centre, even centre-right ground, because they know that those voters are ripe for the picking. And so that's why a lot of people who are on the progressive side of politics in the UK feel very much abandoned by this version of Labour, because they essentially think, well, we've got your votes in the bag, we can just go get some Tory voters.
Do you think that's a problem?
I think it's, to be honest, if Keir Starmer wanted to move more to the right and purely for the purposes of getting the Tories out, I would be okay with it, only if he promised to give us a fair voting system afterwards. Because as I said, this country, since World War II, almost every single election has voted for parties to the left of the Conservative Party. We are a progressive voting country compared to the government that we keep being given. And so if he actually committed to changing the voting system, we wouldn't have to have a situation where...
But he's given no indication of that, has he?
I know that mm-hmm. that's why it's completely unacceptable that he's moving to the right whilst not promising to any real change after that.
Ironically enough, as you'll know, I'm a Labour Party member. I'm not sure if you are, but I'm a Labour Party member. And the majority of the Labour Party members are massively in favour of electoral reform. In fact, we passed it at the last national conference, but it seems to be mm-hmm. ignored at the top echelon.
Yeah, I actually got kicked out of the Labour Party in March 2020 precisely because I said on Twitter, dear any Lib Dems and Greens who are disappointed that I've joined the Labour Party, please understand that I'm doing this because I know that electoral reform and a fair voting system is the best way to save the country. And if I do achieve that, that means the votes of your parties will actually count in all future elections. So me joining the Labour Party and getting them to do an electoral pact is the single best thing I could possibly do for your parties as well. And the Labour Party basically said, nah, we can't have you supporting other parties at the same time when that's not what I was doing. Notion of working together, that notion of equal voting is fundamentally against the leadership of this party. And that's massive division between leadership and the party right now.
I mean, Femi, mate, I'll be honest with you. A lot of people have been kicked out for a lot less. And just to avoid me getting kicked out, we're going to bridge very quickly past this topic. but, you know, I have to be honest with you. I've come on a journey on electoral reform. I haven't been in politics that long. I kind of got involved when I was 16, 17. But early on, I was kind of fed this narrative that first past the post is protects us from extremists like the BNP and others. A lot of that has been debunked. And I've now reached a conclusion, I think, in the last 5 years specifically, that our country is no longer a democracy. You can't have a government of one party in 13 years rule over the country without having achieved 50% of the vote. It's ludicrous, no?
Exactly. I think, and the thing is, it's...
And there are people all across the country, by the way, that I door knock on or engage with or come on the show who say, listen, my vote literally means nothing. Like when I go to the vote, if you're in a safe seat, it's not that it doesn't mean anything. Obviously, there's huge moral value to it. There's symbolic value to it. But as it pertains to electoral math, my vote isn't going to make a difference.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, people often, when you say we need to change the voting system, people accuse you of trying to rig things in favor of Labour. But no, it's not fair regardless of who wins. Because if a party that only a minority of people have voted for always gets a majority of the seats in Parliament, that means that a party that a minority voted for can do anything they want, pass any laws they want, without having to even talk to the parties that the rest of the people voted for, i.e. the majority, which means the majority of votes literally mean nothing.
But it's also...
any effect on the democratic process.
I don't even think it's just electoral math, if I'm honest with you. I think it also helps political discussion. One of the things I was shocked at when I lost to Boris and I went to the States, and I kind of had this British thing of having always grown up here and loving the country of thinking our democracy was better, but I actually found the political discourse in America was better. It was healthier. And even they have their electoral problems with the electoral college and other things. But I don't think it's just an electoral math issue or an issue of who wins and loses the election, but a fairer, more democratic process would surely help healthy democratic debate.
Oh yeah, I mean that's one of the biggest problems, because if you know that in your constituency only one MP can win, only one party can win, you can't have a situation where it's proportional representation whereby you get the votes, the seats get split up based on the percentage of the votes that you get. If only one party can win, then anybody with an even slightly different point of view to you is an existential threat to your beliefs. And so you're automatically talking to the other person as if they're your enemy rather than somebody you can find some common ground with. This proportional, this first past the post system that we have is designed to make us all at each other's throats.
Yeah, and I think nothing is better represented of that by the physical state of Parliament, where they're sat directly opposite each other, almost in a confrontational method. I wrote a paper at this about in university. I'm sure if I read it back now, it would suck. But the idea was that our democracy is built for confrontation. Okay, we're going to move on to the next story, and it's one that you're familiar with. I had a quick look at your Twitter feed, and I watched one of your YouTube videos about this really, really sad, tragic case, and that is the case of Lucy Letby. Now, for those who don't know, Lucy Letby was a suspended nurse found guilty of murdering 7 babies and attempting to murder a further 6 others between June 2015 and June 2016. You will have seen this all across the news. This week alone, the president of the RCN, which is the Royal College of Nurses, has said that Lucy Letby may have been stopped sooner if she wasn't white. And there's a big debate going on, and I think it's been a little bit toxic online around whether Lucy Letby was allowed to get as far as she did because of the color of her skin, because she was a white nurse. And I think the institutional racism that exists within the healthcare system is one that isn't really up for debate. The data is there, as you have highlighted on your YouTube channel. Can you tell us a little bit, expand a little bit about your thoughts on this and whether you agree with the president of the RCN, who is saying that Lucy Letby may have been stopped sooner if she wasn't white?
So we're starting with a major, major tragedy here, which was allowed to happen because complaints and concerns were raised against Lucy Letby. There were warnings that were made, and those were essentially ignored by the authorities. And instead of actually punishing her and making sure that she wasn't able to do what she did, they actually made the doctors who raised the alarm apologize to her. Now, that is by definition something, a massive professional failure. And so the question is, what allowed that to happen? And we have to be objective here. When I made this point on Twitter or on YouTube, I had lots of people that were angry with me that how dare you bring race into this. But it is a matter of fact that the Nursing and Midwifery Council, which basically decides if people get to keep being nurses, they've done studies on this that show that if you are, there are several stages. You have to go through the complaints process, then there's the screening process, there's an investigation process, and then you find out the outcome. Now, according to them, you have more people from ethnic minorities who are complained against, but then at the next stage, at the screening stage, where they haven't actually done the full investigation yet, white nurses are more likely to be found innocent, and therefore the whole thing gets closed, i.e. they're deemed innocent. After that, at the next stage, once the investigation is concluded, ethnic minority nurses, black nurses especially, are more likely to be found innocent than white nurses. And white nurses at the end of the process are more likely to be struck off, which means that it is easier to essentially strike off a black nurse than a white nurse. And essentially the system protects white nurses disproportionately more than other people. Mm-hmm. So you have to ask yourself, if that is the thinking that is going through the people that are making these decisions, then doesn't that mean that it makes it more likely that a white nurse that is doing something wrong is less likely to be sanctioned for it?
Yeah, I think where the criticism has come is that we can discuss the institutional racism that exists within nursing and within the NHS and healthcare in general in the UK. I think where people have been uncomfortable is actually directly linking it to a single case. As you started your response to my question, you mentioned very rightly this is a huge tragedy. We've had 7 babies murdered, an attempted murder on a further 6 in a period of just 1 year. And I think where the criticism has been is, listen, we can all agree that the institution, I don't, you know, this isn't one of those shows where we put facts up for debate on the show, right? If a fact is a fact, it's not up for debate. You can't have a differing opinion on tangible fact. And I think the research is absolutely conclusive on institutional racism in these sectors. Then the criticism has been, is it inappropriate when 7 families have lost their children to link this directly to racism when there isn't any direct evidence to suggest that fact?
So we're looking for answers. We're trying to figure out how to avoid this happening again. And I find that it's similar to when you have a mass shooting in America, people immediately go to gun control. We need to control the guns. And then you'll have the pushback from people saying, oh, but we've had a tragedy now. We can't be talking about politics.
Femi, the difference with guns is that when there's a school shooting that happens in America, that is the direct variable is the gun. Right, we don't have any evidence that the direct variable of Lucy Letby being allowed to do this is race. There's very different things.
We don't have any evidence to prove that it definitely was the case in this case.
Whereas with guns, it's very clear.
Yes, obviously. But what we're trying to do is make sure that we remove as many barriers as we can see that that prevent guilty nurses from being sanctioned and stopped. And given that we can see that there is one that we have lots of evidence for, if we actually care about those babies, we should be trying to get rid of any evidence that we can see. If you can point to another factor that can that would have meant that.
Oh, I think we've got some technical issues with Femi there. We're just going to try to get him back now, but I think he was rounding off his answer around this, and I think what Femi was trying to point to is the fact that, listen, we're not suggesting specifically that this was an issue that she would have been stopped with rape with as a result of race, but I mean the president of the RCN has said that they do believe that Lucy Letby may have been stopped sooner if she wasn't white. But I think what Femi, if I'm not misinterpreting his answer, was saying that there are multiple variables, but if one of them is race,
why wouldn't we talk about that now in order to eliminate it from happening in the future? The next story, and hopefully we're going to try and get Femi back, but the next story is surrounding the RNC debates last night, so the Republican Party debates. Femi, I've got you back. I think you were just rounding off your answer around, listen, if I'm not misinterpreting it, was saying that, you know, if even if this is one variable, surely if we care about this not happening in the future, we need to address it.
Exactly. If you could point to a different option as to how what part of the system favored Lucy Letby against the doctors who are raising concerns, then sure, let's go for that as well. But we're just pointing out one. Just in fact, I find it to be extremely problematic if when we are giving an option as to this might have been responsible for the deaths of these babies, you're then saying, no, we have to protect institutional racism.
Yeah. I think where you're right is that this isn't a case of a nurse, you know, sort of abusing her position and killing one child. There has clearly been an institutional failure here. As it pertains to the trust and the NHS and the response to that, given that she had, you know, doctors had raised alarm over it. So I think your response is a good one in that it's saying this isn't a reaction to a single case, but an institutional failure. And if racism is a part of that institutional failure, how can we not talk about it? How can we not address it?
Exactly. I mean, the term that we use in law is necessary but not sufficient. As in, just because it is necessary to address this element, even if it's not the thing that's going to solve the entire problem, you have to address the problems that you can see. And this is a clear and glaring problem that we can see.
Yeah.
Especially when you had BBC journalists literally saying, this is not what a serial baby killer should look like.
Yeah, and that statement certainly wouldn't have been said if Lucy Letby had been a black nurse. I think that is, again, indisputable. Lastly, last story, we've gone a little bit over, but you know, I think we've had a really, really good discussion. I've enjoyed having you on. Is on the theme of the show this week, which is education. So Sir Keir Starmer has claimed he would be unable to go to university if he were a school leaver now, raising the prospect that Labour will announce plans to help students with the cost of living crisis. The Labour leader said the economic climate and soaring prices would have stopped my dream cold in its tracks if he wanted to study law today. His comments suggest the party could soon announce policies to help students with rising rent and other costs if he becomes Prime Minister. Now, for context of people, when Keir Starmer went to university, higher education was free. The tuition fees was brought about starting with Tony Blair's government, but really ramped up by the coalition government, who tripled tuition fees. So Keir Starmer studied law. Femi, I believe you studied law, but you paid very different prices for them.
Yeah, it was still 3K when I was doing it.
3K more than he paid.
My brother had to pay is slightly more than that.
And so do you...
But yeah.
How, you know, if we have a combination of things, from tuition fees to the maintenance grants turning into loans to the cost of living crisis to the bursaries for nurses, for example, that have been scrapped... How prohibitive is our education system becoming? And do you worry that stories like yours, like mine, might not be possible in the future, maybe even Keir Starmer's, for people not being able to afford to get their higher education degree?
I think it starts right from the bottom. I think the fact that we need to have more funding to deal with the fact that the massive attainment gap between working class kids and private school kids. I mean, we had the Tories literally using an algorithm that gave the best grades to private school kids during the pandemic, or they had to reverse that right at the end. We've recently seen that with the recent A-level and GCSE grades, the gap between rich and poor has only gotten wider. In fact, their education czar, their advisor for the government as to how to help the working class kids catch up after the pandemic, he actually quit because the Tories refused to provide enough money. So we need to focus on this because it is going to be a massive dent on social mobility if education stops being a way to move your way up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the major things that we need to be focusing on.
We spoke earlier about the sort of slap in the face, and I always thought that this was a slap in the face. We spoke about it when it comes to bankers and FTSE 100 bosses, but I always thought it's a bit of a slap in the face when politicians who literally enjoyed a free education tell the next generation that it's no longer affordable. That is in and of itself spitting in the face of the next generation for me, no?
Oh, 100%. Pulling up the ladder is just basically the way that this government likes to roll. I mean, we have what they've done. They essentially created their lives in an economy that worked for them, and they've done everything they can to trash it. And we're having, I mean, what we've gone through as millennials and Gen Zs in the last 10 years alone has been insane. Yeah. And they went through none of this, and they've made our lives worse before they then...
Yeah, I mean, me and you are similar ages. I think you're just a little bit older than me. But I think, you know, our generation went through the 2008 crash, the housing crisis, tuition fees being trebled, maintenance grants being gotten rid of, Brexit on top of cost of living crisis and pandemic. How much more can they hit us with?
And Russia as well. It has been, and I think the thing that's painful is if things were bad, that is one thing. But if you have a government that is deliberately hurting us, that makes it so much worse. And I mean both the Tories and Labour, in the sense that in 2019, the government's experts released the documents that showed that no matter what version of Brexit they negotiated, it would make people poor, which means that by pursuing Brexit, they were deliberately making everybody in this country poor after 8 years of austerity, which is insane. And the fact that it's been allowed to do policies that you know that all your experts say is going to hurt people, that needs to be fixed, which is why for me Brexit is just a symbol of it's like the testing knob for how bad our politics mm-hmm. is. Are politicians willing to just deliberately hurt us?
Yeah.
And the fact that Keir Starmer is refusing to stand against it, that's a major problem as well.
It is, and we're going to be staying on this topic of education next, as we have Tom Allingham, Communications Director at Save the Student and an expert on student finance, joining us. We've just had The Week Unwrapped with our guest, Femi Olawale, activist, writer, and co-founder of Our Future, Our Choice. Femi, thank you so much for joining us. Femi Olawale there, media voice, political activist, and co-founder of Our Future, Our Voice. Moving on to the next of our best bits, it was Labour Party conference in October, and one of the most memorable moments from the week was when Sir Keir Starmer being glitter bombed by activist Yaz Ashmawi. We spoke exclusively to Yaz about the event and whether he had any regrets over his actions. We were the very first to speak to him. I think over 200 media articles followed our interview. So give a listen and see if you can spot my surprise in relation to some of his responses to the questions. Yaz, thank you so much for joining us. Just tell me about the last 24 hours. Or 48 hours.
Well, thanks for having me on here. Yeah, I mean, it was obviously quite an intense experience. I'd love to talk about like why I did it.
Yeah, we're gonna do lots of that. I just want to get your own personal stuff. Don't worry, I've given plenty of time to on the issue. First of all, your background's on point. If the branding was off, we now know you're definitely the guy who did it. I just wanted to know the personal experience. What happened? How did you get there and what happened in the immediacy afterwards? I think a lot of people have heard you got arrested, but haven't heard what's happened since.
Well, the thing is, I put my hand on his arm, didn't I? And I touched him.
Yeah.
And I think that he, you know, politicians, they get a lot of death threats and they have a need to feel safe. And I sort of compromised that in that moment by touching him. So anyway, I was dragged off. I got onto the stage because everyone was applauding. And so I hopped onto some chairs and hopped onto the stage. I was kept in a cell for about 22 hours. I know he was concerned. He was going to write a letter to the police about assault. So I guess I've sort of owned up to that in a way. I kind of.
Do you regret that? Because what I was going to ask you about that at the end of the interview, but I guess we'll do it now. Safety of politicians is a big thing. I stood for Parliament. I got more death threats than I think anyone else did in that series. So jumping up with his wife there, his children probably watching and touching him will have been a hugely scary moment, not just for him, but for every MP watching. Do you regret the action? Do you regret touching him? Where are you at now?
The thought that like, even for a moment, he felt like he was in danger is horrible to think about. And, you know, I think that it's absolutely fine to pour glitter on someone and to go onto the stage. I just think it's the physical contact that mm-hmm. crossed the line there. But, you know, I hope that he can understand that the people of this country have a right to contribute to the decisions which will determine whether or not we live or die. And our whole electoral system is not fit to govern, mm-hmm. can't protect us. You know, I'm a scientist. I studied physics while I was at university, and I'm terrified about this crisis in our climate and in nature, and we see society falling apart around us, and we can't keep reinforcing the systems that have given us here. We've got a crisis to fix and a broken political system that can't actually do the job.
Yeah, so talk to us about this. So you're a campaigner with People Demand Democracy. I believe People Demand Democracy is a fairly new organization. Talk to us a little bit about that. And what drove you to doing the protest? I think when you, I'll be honest, I was at conference and I heard you sat I at first I thought it was either it was Just Stop Oil or it must be something like that. But you shouted, "People demand a people's house." So talk to us a little bit about what that means.
People Demand Democracy is, yeah, it's a brand new campaign. It's designed to escalate towards the upcoming election. We've got expertise from some of the most influential nonviolent direct action movements in the last decade, like you've mentioned. And we demand an upgraded form of democracy where ordinary people have a say on the way politicians behave. We need to make them work for us and not for lobbyists and themselves. So 100 years ago, the suffragettes knew they deserved a voice. They couldn't take no for an answer, could they? They interrupted hustings and debates and news events and panel shows and speeches. And I imagine we'll see similar things over the course of this next year. Like wherever there's visibility, ordinary people will demand a platform to present an actual alternative to our broken system. We have a right to say on these decisions in public. The people, you know, we're facing the biggest drop in living standards since record began. 2/3 of people believe that politicians are just out for themselves. They want a new electoral system. Only 3% of people think the House of Lords should stay as it is. And we, you know, we are, if I can talk about the science for a minute, because we are facing an emergency, right? Basic climate science indicates that even if we reach our Paris target of 2 degrees, we'll see stronger storms, more extreme seasons, coral reefs will be lost, billions will struggle to find water. And there was this paper that was just published a few weeks ago. It was this big review that looked at the human impact of carbon emissions. It found that mainly richer humans will be responsible for killing 1 billion mainly poorer humans, right? There is an immediate threat to life. There's an urgent need for these far-reaching changes in all aspects of societies. And citizens' assemblies are the answer. They are the intervention that we are looking for everywhere in our politics. It's a solution actually on the scale of the problem.
So I guess what I'm understanding is the problem can be an issue like climate change, but the route to fixing it is fixing our democracy. And the way do we fix our democracy is this citizens' assembly. We've previously, I think we had James Robertson on the show previously, who has advocated very similar things. The talks around a democratic lottery system, a people's house.
That's what it is. Yeah.
And is this a replacement of the House of Lords? Is it its own separate thing? Is it a replacement for the House of Commons?
I don't think it's a replacement for the House of Commons. There's different forms it can take. The Sortition Foundation, who are the biggest experts in the country when it comes to deliberative democracy and citizens' assemblies, they've run the vast majority of them, are proposing it replaces the House of Lords. I think there's a strong case that we need to update our politics in that way. But you know, what's really important to understand about this vision for a House of Citizens is that fundamentally what it does is it realigns power in society. It empowers people to set the agenda, and by deciding on topics for citizens' assemblies on issues, can keep politicians in check by holding these independent public inquiries. And it basically gives this house a say on the laws that politicians enact and write in that and vote on in that house. You know, it sort of dismantles us, it frees us from the capture of interest and repairs our relationships, right, with our communities and with nature. It can in our economy, in our public services, in our climate, in our politics. Only normal people brought together, given the time, the science, the guidance, can actually make the right decisions for our country. Mm-hmm. People are desperate for something different, and we need to update politics and let people decide. And that's the hope, really, that we can bring a new message, a new possibility to people's minds as the next.
I tell you what, Yaz, what I'm hearing from what you're saying, and I have to be honest, you know, I it's in the context of the Just Stop Oil protests, the XR protests. It feels like to me there is an element of a feeling of powerlessness and a frustration with politics, not just from you, but from a lot of people around the country. And again, forgive me if I'm misunderstanding you, but it sounds like there are elements of what happened at the conference speech that you regret, but that need for politics to change, to stop the tinkering around the edges and for fundamentally people's voices to be heard, that's the sort of fire that's burning.
Yeah, absolutely, right. And we are tired of being ignored, right? We can't afford to be ignored when we're facing a catastrophe like this. And, you know, take something like as basic as proportional representation, this idea of making your votes fairly count, that the number of representatives in parliament actually reflects the proportion of people that want that ideology being represented. It's a bare minimum for an electoral system.
Yeah.
But and 80% of the Labour membership voted for it, but Starmer has completely ignored. The leadership doesn't even believe in the democracy of its own party. So how can we trust them to listen to the actual public?
And that's where a lot of the frustration is coming. And I guess my final question is, what does the next few weeks or months look like for you? Do you think you're going to be charged on this? Do you know what the outcome might look like? It does sound like you regret certain elements of it, right? Do you want
to? Yeah, I mean, look, non-violence is about intervention to prevent harm, and it's about accountability. And if Mr. Starmer felt that he was threatened, and I know that he was going to write that statement.
And listen, I'm sure he did. Look, I saw the look on his face.
Right.
I'm sure I would have had the same look on my face. The amount of death threats that are received are critical, and I think the touching of the hand and the physical element is what would have been most alarming.
Yeah, and I take responsibility for that. I want to take full responsibility for my actions.
Do you want to apologize to him on that element?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry for doing that. I just think, you know, that for those of you who are watching this, who feel that there is this need for something different, you can participate along with us, right? Join this open call. We have a welcome call on this Friday, a week on Friday, the 20th of October. PeopleDemandDemocracy.com, you can sign up. And this can be the start of something, you know. There can be a different way, and we can all, you know.
I hear your regret, but I also hear this frustration at the political system, and not just from you, from a lot of young people specifically. They're just fucked off, right? That the system, that there, it feels like, what was that film? Don't Look Up. It feels like a meteor is headed towards the earth. And a lot of people are shouting for us to do something, and the system just won't let us. And it feels like that is what's driving a lot of the actions. And it's not an accident that all these different interventions, protests, campaigns, direct actions are happening at the same time. There's a feeling of powerlessness in our politics that I think we have to address.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well...
Yeah, I'll let you continue, but thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Join me next week for a final edition of Politics Uncensored, the best bits. Not a final edition of the show, but when we look back on the best of 2023, where I will be revisiting my extended interview with former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you next week. Salams.